versus Fisher Investment. Mr. Leipold.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Leipold on behalf of the appellant of Fisher Investment Capital. Your Honor, this is a non-dischargeability action under 523A2B. The lower courts, the bankruptcy judge, bankruptcy court, and the district court found that the Fisher had failed to meet two of the requirements under 523, specifically that the statement made in writing was false, and that the was materially false, and that the information was given with the intent to deceive. The issue, Your Honor, I believe, really centers on sort of a definition of a word, hopeful. The accounts receivables have been testified, or some portion of thereof, as being hopeful. But it's not clear what that means. I don't know if it's hopeful as to collection or hopeful as that the accounts receivable will actually exist. In that context, Your Honor, that is a omission in the written statement that my client relied on.
Had Mr. Leipold, why does Ms. Borchardt's testimony that some of the accounts receivable were just hopeful show material falsity? Does the record tell us that she had no reason to think these receivables would actually materialize? Just for example.
Well, Your Honor, in the transcript of her deposition at A289-290, she answers in her deposition, and I quote, and these were actual invoices. You know, they were just pretty much, you know, a lot of these are, we think this is going to make $15,000. I didn't bill them $15,000. So, granted, it's not the model of clarity, but a lot of my questions and depositions are not the model of clarity. I think what she's saying there, Your Honor, is she doesn't really know whether these receivables are going to materialize or not, and not whether they're going to be collected yet.
Do we know from the record how many of accounts receivable in the list, if any, were never actually collected?
Well, that's the problem, Your Honor. When in the course of the discovery, we tried to find that information, and unfortunately, there's a lack of real information as to the collection of those receivables. So, Your Honor, I would. So, when you look at really those two components, material false, we believe that omission is as great a sin as commission.
So wait, I'm so sorry, but
no problem.
So there's no evidence that the company failed to collect on these receivables?
Your Honor, there's
I realize that at the time it was before Judge Golgar and Judge Holderman both said that Fisher had no idea whether the receivables were collected or not. But to this day, we don't know.
Your Honor, there was just a lack of information. I point to the transcript at the appendix at 2288, Ms. Boschert's deposition again, where she concludes that they did not know where these documents were located regarding these receivables. I assume at some level, Your Honor, some of these were collected. I can't tell the court whether all of them actually materialized into even what I would consider accounts receivable, actually money actually owed the debtor corporation. That's where I come back to the word hopeful. This isn't just, gee, we have a $100,000 receivable and we're hopeful it's going to collect. This is, we're not even sure, we're hopeful that we're going to generate the $100,000 receivable. And I think that's sort of a fundamental misrepresentation. Call it an account receivable.
Well, what's the evidence that these hopeful receivables were without any basis in fact? I guess that's...
Well, Your Honor, it's clearly our burden to prove that these receivables are materially false. But we don't have any contrary evidence. All we have is the testimony that these receivables were hopeful. We don't have a designation on that record that says, oh, by the way, we're not sure about these receivables. There's no footnoting. There's no asterisk that says, you know, these may be collected or they may not be collected, or as I think Ms. Borchardt is testifying, they may exist or they may not exist depending upon some future event. The other component of this, Your Honor, is the receivables, a lot of these receivables that were alleged receivables that are issue here were substantially larger than the receivables that the debtor generally generated. We believe that creates a sense of, I don't know, puffery might be the right word, might be the kindest word in that, but we believe that there was a misrepresentation that these receivables actually existed and that they were collectible. The lower court's already concluded, and it wasn't appealed from, that my client relied on this financial statement in making these conclusions and making this original loan.
Were these receivables cash receivables, or were they in kind, or what did they amount to?
The business was job lotting, Your Honor. I believe that it was cash to be collected somewhere down the road. I'm not sure how it was necessarily created other than the work created, but I don't know whether there was an actual invoice or a letter or an email of some sort that says, oh, by the way, we sold this, now you owe us this money. I'm not sure it was a formalized QuickBooks, you know, they generate accounts receivable on a regular basis. And we believe that those components, Your Honor, deal with the question of whether or not the statement was materially false. And there is no contrary evidence. We don't have evidence that they're true other than the testimony of the defendants and the party saying, gee, they're true. But that becomes more of a he said, she said sort of component. And our conclusion, Your Honor, is that from a summary judgment perspective, it would be best for the court, the lower court, the bankruptcy court, to actually hear the testimony of the parties and draw a conclusion about the veracity of the witnesses in that context.
Well, I must say, I mean, you make a reasonable case for the notion that Mr. Cohen might be less than forthcoming, but it was Ms. Borchert who prepared the list of receivables. What evidence would permit us to combine Mr. Cohen's suspect credibility with Ms. Borchert's drafting of the list and arrive at an intent to deceive? In other words, for instance, is there evidence that he told her what to put on the list?
Your Honor, we don't have direct evidence of that. What we do have, Your Honor, is that they were partners both in business and in life. They both were partners in this business. She acquired her interest in this business without any capital contribution. They had two children together. They lived together. So there was we think that the parties, I can't really even wouldn't be able to get into that information given the relationship that they share, but they clearly, Mr. Cohen.
Aren't they married?
I don't know, Your Honor. I just know that they're partners, and both components.
But I mean, there's no spousal.
Spousal immunity.
Immunity.
I understand that, Your Honor. We in this context have always tried to find out more information about this. Mr. Cohen had knowledge of this receivable. The loan was being obtained through Job Ladder. He is a principal of Job Ladder. He would have had to have known as the president that what was being offered on Job Ladder's behalf, his company. Finally, Your Honor, the other component of this is really the intent to deceive. I think that these factors tend to merge a little bit together, but I believe that there is actually an intent here because there's clearly a number of issues as to whether the receivables existed, going back to the puffery or the hopeful comment, because had that information not been provided, the information is being provided with the intent to obtain the loan, preserve that aspect of it and get that loan from my client who's clearly relying upon this information and making the loan.
What evidence is there, counsel, of the reasonableness of your client's reliance?
We have my client's testimony, Your Honor. It's not an issue that's been raised on appeal. That issue has been decided both by the bankruptcy court and the district court that his reliance was reasonable. But the conclusion was, Your Honor, is that his testimony as deposition is, had I known that these receivables were less than genuine or less than true, I would not have made the loan.
But how, in what sense is it reasonable for a lending institution to rely on a handwritten list of accounts receivable such as that which was at issue here in extending a $200,000 loan?
Well, Your Honor, it's clearly my client makes loans at a more aggressive position than Chase Bank, for example.
So you're entitled to do it on the fly?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't accept that, but I would accept the fact that we're dealing with, you know, debtors who we're asking to provide us detailed information. I'm not sure that necessarily the fact that it was written or on a computer would have generated any real difference, but I think when it's offered, there has to be some sense of...
Raises the due diligence red flag, don't you think?
Well, Your Honor, that I agree. That very much could be a due diligence issue here, but as I say, my time's over. But I think the due diligence issue is something that could have been raised at trial on these issues on the reliance argument and would expect to be if this court were to remand it back ultimately to the bankruptcy court for a trial on the merits.
I didn't think we were reviewing a trial record. I thought this was summary
judgment. Correct, Your Honor.
So our review is de novo.
Correct, Your Honor.
So if the record reflects an absence of reasonable reliance, we can affirm on that basis. Except that the argument wasn't made.
The argument wasn't made, nor were the information. Thank you very much. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you.
Ms. Coulter?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Marcia Kotler, here on behalf of appellee Avi Cohn. Your Honor, both Judge Goldgar and Judge Holderman considered the evidence, including the circumstantial evidence that Fisher Investment is urging this court to consider, and correctly found that Fisher failed to put forth sufficient evidence to create a genuine issue of fact as to two critical elements of a Section 523A2B claim. Specifically, they failed to put forth sufficient evidence, one, that Jobwater's list of accounts receivables was materially false, and two, that Cohn had the requisite intent to deceive Fisher Investment. Because the record is devoid of affirmative facts that the written statements were either false or that Cohn had intent to deceive, Fisher wishes this court to find that Judge Goldgar erred in not filling in the missing facts by way of inferences.
Now, inferences. If some of the accounts receivable on the list proved to Fisher were just hopeful, as Ms. Borscher testified, then was the list material misleading to the extent that neither Ms. Borscher nor Mr. Cohen didn't disclose the hopeful nature of those receivables?
Well, Judge Rovner, that's a good question, and I think the answer is no, it was not materially false based on her testimony that the list of receivables was hopeful. And in context, I think it's important to point out that Ms. Borscher explained that while some of the receivables were actual invoice numbers, which had actual invoice numbers assigned, there were others, and they numbered only a few. If you look on the list, most of them have invoice numbers. There are a few that do not. And she said that those were hopeful, explaining that these amounts are what we think we are going to make. And I think it's important to note that at the top of the list states that these are approximate accounts receivable. So I think the language on the list of receivables is wholly consistent with Mr. Borchardt's testimony that some of the receivables are hopeful.
Counsel, will you just explain to me briefly this business, how did it operate?
Your Honor, it was a business run out of the home. The job lotting business is essentially buying and selling obsolete, damaged, overstocked goods. This business was run somewhat informally. As you can see, the list of receivables written on a piece of ledger paper, handwritten. And the record keeping was not as complete as other businesses might be. And again, the nature of the business was such that receivables would get in. Some of the goods, the nature of the goods, are damaged.
Would these be businesses that would contact Mr. Cohen or the corporation?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that businesses that had goods that they couldn't move because they were damaged or overstocked or so forth would contact Mr. Cohen, and then he would be the middleman, not always even take possession of the goods, but then move the goods to someone else who might be willing to take these goods. Your Honor, the second point that Fisher makes and alleges creates a material issue of fact as to material falsity is that Ms. Borchardt said that the receivables were not typical of job ladder's receivables. But again, she said that she believed the entire list to be accurate, and just because they were not typical, both Judge Golgar and Judge Holderman considered that evidence and found that did not indicate or infer that they were not, in fact, accurate. In fact, she believed them to be accurate. I'd like to move on, though, to the second issue, which is the issue of intent. And as Judge Golgar correctly found, if you don't have material falsity, you don't even get to the second issue, which is the issue of intent to deceive. But I point out that even in cases in which material falsity is found to exist, courts have not necessarily found intent to deceive, such that they are two separate and distinct elements that need to be proven. Fisher's argument is essentially that Cohn is a generally dishonest guy, and therefore he must have been dishonest with respect to the written statement of accounts receivable. And I note again that it was Ms. Borchardt who prepared the list and presented the list to Fisher Investment. It was not Cohn.
But it certainly does sound like...
Yes, my understanding...
They're more than business acquaintances.
Yes, Your Honor. It is my understanding that they are both business partners and have a personal relationship as well. But the problem with Fisher's argument is that the alleged circumstantial evidence it argues creates a genuine issue of fact as to intent, has absolutely no connection or relevance to the written statement at issue. And I think that's the focus here. The conduct from 20 years prior or 4 years later after the loan was made is completely irrelevant as to what this court recognized in Ray Sheridan was that intent to deceive can only be inferred from conduct which the debtor knows will induce another to make a loan. And Judge Golgar considered the alleged circumstantial evidence raised by Fisher, specifically finding that a 20-year-old conviction was of, quote, dubious admissibility, and that contradictory evidence concerning the disposition of a watch was insufficient to infer fraudulent conduct with respect to the written statement at issue here, the list of counts receivable. And under this court's ruling in Sheridan, Judge Goldgar's findings should be reviewed for clear error and should only be overturned, and when I quote from the Sheridan opinion, when the court is left to with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. And I don't think that Judge Golgar committed a mistake in finding that Fisher could not, quote, stave off summary judgment by discrediting Cohn's denials. And moreover, I'd like to point out that all the cases cited by Fisher, including the Sheridan case cited by the Seventh Circuit, show that alleged circumstantial evidence, while they can be considered, and incidentally, in Sheridan, the circumstantial evidence in that case was found insufficient to infer fraudulent intent. Well, while circumstantial evidence can be considered, it has to be concerning the written statement at issue. In that case, it was specifically the aggressive method used by a debtor in valuing his property, which ended up overestimating his risk and under-evaluating his property, and then presented that to the creditor. But again, the point here is that the circumstantial evidence has to be to induce the loan and surrounding the circumstances of the loan. Everything cited by Fisher in the record has nothing to do with the loan itself. Your Honor, just to summarize, I think Judge Golgar was correct in finding, and Judge Holderman was correct in affirming, that there's simply insufficient evidence to create a material issue of fact that the receivables were false or that Cohn intended to deceive Fisher. And Fisher's totality of the circumstances argument is asking this court to find that Judge Golgar committed clear error in determining that Cohn's alleged lack of credibility as to unrelated matters necessarily infers his lack of credibility with respect to the written statement at issue. I think Judge Golgar correctly refused to make such an impermissible inference, and the district court correctly affirmed him. I'd be happy to answer. I see I have a few minutes left if you have any questions, Your Honors.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Your time had run out. I'll give you another minute if you need.
I have 1 minute, Your Honor.
All right.
I will thank you. Thank you very much.
Your Honor, I would point out just one simple fact, as counsel for Mr. Cohn admitted, is that the receivable said what we think we are going to make. An account receivable is something you've already made. not something you're going to make. And so clearly it's not even an account receivable. It's probably just a hope that money, a business will create it. So with that component, Your Honor, that I'll conclude.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.